And what I'm going to do is I'm going to argue that with some reasonable assumptions, that the answer is yes. And at the same time, I'm going to define what I really mean by eternal inflation being in our past. That sounds a bit funny to say that inflation is eternal and yet it's ended. So I'll describe more precisely what I mean by this. But the first thing I need you to do, so this is going to be on the blackboard, and this technology is very impressive, but I'm going to need to go back and forth between these boards, and I'm also going to need you to vote on some propositions. And so I need you guys to do me a favor and come like down in the lower half of this auditorium. You can still do your email, but just come farther down so that if you want to pay attention, you can read what I'm writing. And, you know, I did teach high school, which is not helpful right now, but I also taught some middle school students. And I really would like it if you guys would come down. Try to behave as well as high school students. Okay, thank you. So this is going to be the first part of the talk. It's argued that there are some reasonable assumptions that lead to this conclusion. And I think for many people here, it's obvious that eternal inflation is the right idea. And to many other people, it's obvious that it's the wrong idea. And so I think it's worth kind of stating what these assumptions are to see where we diverge. And then in the second part, which I hope to have time for, I'm going to just address very briefly, does the theory agree with observation? For example, Neil was saying that the theory couldn't possibly predict such a flat universe as we see. There's many questions like that, whether the theory can agree with observation. And I'm going to argue that with some additional assumptions, which are highly non-trivial, but not obviously wrong, that the answer to this question is yes. But, of course, there's a lot of dangers there, and there's a lot of future tests that this theory could fail. And so I think that's an exciting situation. So now, just for convenience, I'm going to use a semi-classical four-dimensional description. That's not essential for what I'm going to do. But now, we do need a rigorous description of eternal inflation. And we don't have that. And so there could be something big that we're missing. I think that's definitely an interesting possibility. What I'm going to do today is I'm just going to make conservative assumptions. I mean, everybody claims to be conservative, and I'm no exception. I'm going to make conservative assumptions based on the current state of knowledge. Okay? But clearly there could be surprises in store there. And so these assumptions I'm not going to be able to state with complete rigor. And please don't nitpick them. I mean, I'm telling you right away, we need a more rigorous description of this whole system. Okay? So here's my first assumption. My first assumption is that the landscape contains at least one minimum, one false vacuum, that has a positive cosmological constant, and it has a decay rate that's small compared to the Hubble rate, where that Hubble rate is set by the value of this cosmological constant. That's the first assumption. All right. Now, I would like to take a vote on this assumption here. How many people think that this is likely to be correct? There's no negotiating. Okay, and that's maybe around 20 or so. And how many people think that this is incorrect? One? I think I see four. Okay. So yes, we'll say around 25, and no, we'll say four. Listen. Well, a lot of people are seem to be agnostic even about this simple question. Yeah. Okay, so, and I would just say, first of all, there's some theoretical evidence for this, based on our best understanding of string theory, which certainly needs improving. And there's also some observational evidence. I mean, the simplest explanation for what we see is that we have a positive cosmological constant. And once the decay is non-perturbative, the simplest explanation of the data is that we live in a metastable vacuum with a positive cosmological constant. In that situation, the decay is non-perturbative. And it's very easy to satisfy this, but because the decay is exponentially suppressed. Okay, so that's the reason to think that this is the case. Sorry, yeah, so at least metastable. That's right. All right, so let's just say that data suggests stable or metastable lambda greater than zero. Yeah, we could. Yeah. So, okay, thank you. I think this number we can leave the same. So. Okay, so then what's a consequence of this assumption? A consequence is that, first of all, let's just talk classically. I'm going to need to draw a potential. Okay, this is obviously just a picture to help us think about this. Let's draw a potential like this. Okay? So let's think of this as this false vacuum here. All right. So a consequence of this is that classically, if you start with some particular initial conditions with zero time derivatives on a three sphere, then the solution is the sitter, as you all know. Now, quantum mechanically, of course, the field can decay by tunneling. We have decays by bubble nucleation. But nevertheless, we end up with a situation where classically we have the sitter space. Here's the initial conditions here. And quantum mechanically, we make all kinds of bubbles of different vacua, at least for this potential that we have here. But the vacuum expands faster than it decays if we're in this situation. And so the volume in the false vacuum still increases exponentially with time, where this parameter gamma is the decay rate in Hubble units. Okay? And so what we produce already in this simple model, an infinite volume in the false vacuum and an infinite number of pocket universes. Okay. Now, let's talk about how sensitive these initial conditions are. So, first of all, classically, we can imagine perturbing around these initial conditions. But let's fix the volume to be some finite thing. And let's put in a UV cutoff on the perturbations. Then the space of perturbations around these simple initial conditions is finite dimensional. And I can draw it heuristically like this. Here's the space of initial conditions. Here's the special symmetric initial conditions that lead to the sitter space. These initial conditions here. And here's the space of eternal inflation initial conditions that allow for eternal inflation. And here's the initial conditions that don't allow for eternal inflation. Yes? I'm just talking about on the initial condition surface, so it could be in physical size, because we have a finite sphere. I've constrained the volume to be finite. Well, you could call it, I'm just doing it at some fixed time, so it could be a physical length scale. Yeah. Well, I was thinking of just imposing UV cutoff on the space of perturbations I was going to consider, and not in the full theory. But I think this is one of those details that, like, obviously there's a deep question behind that. Okay, but all right. So if I just restrict to perturbations that have a physical size smaller than some scale at that time, then the picture looks like this. And so eternal inflation is generic in the technical sense, that there's an open set of initial conditions that allow for it with these cutoffs. But of course, in the sense that we really care, we don't know yet whether this is generic or not. Okay. Now, quantum mechanically, I think what we expect is, as long as we have finite initial conditions, even if they happen to be a negatively curved space with identifications that's collapsing, as long as we have finite initial conditions, then we expect a finite probability for eternal inflation to happen. Okay, because you just roughly need to transition to one of these states, you just need to have non-zero overlap with this part of the space that allows for eternal inflation. Okay? And so, well, you don't have to start with collapsing initial data, but if you did and everything was finite, I think there would be a finite probability for a bounce. If you make an infinite amount of stuff collapsing, then probably not. But with a finite amount of stuff, it's hard to see how you could prevent that. So, yeah, if you want to, I just want to have a non-zero quantum amplitude to bounce. Okay, so that's different. You're sort of trying to, yeah. Well, I'll get to that in just a second, I think. I think I will. Well, so let me tell you the assumption I want to make here, and then let's discuss. Yeah. Well, I'll get to that. Be patient here. Okay, so I'm going to second make an assumption about initial conditions. First of all, that there's a finite probability for eternal inflation, given these initial conditions. And second of all, that the only infinities come from eternal inflation. In other words, that the initial conditions are finite in themselves. They don't have any infinite volume or anything like that. Okay? So that's the assumption I would like to make here. And are you prepared to vote? So let's see if we can get a little more, a little better voter turnout this time. Okay, but all right, fine. We can vote separately. So a finite probability for eternal inflation. Who votes yes? Okay, that's a pretty large number. All right, I'm going to call that 30. And who votes no on that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. People are raising their hands rather low, I guess. Everybody else is agnostic here. So, all right. And then what about the second proposition, that the only infinities come, in other words, that the initial conditions should be finite, and the only infinities should come from the dynamical evolution? So, Okay. Let me just be very concrete. It's a little vague, so let me just say finite volume initial conditions. In other words, that the expectation value for the initial volume is bounded. Okay. So, in some sense, yeah. Right. No, so, okay, so this could be... All right, but I think this lower one is well enough to find that we could bet on it, that we could vote on it, okay? So who's going to vote yes for finite volume initial conditions? Yeah. Well, this is an assumption that I'm going to use. Okay, that looks more like 10 or maybe 12, let's say 12 people. And how about no on this one? One, two, I think I see six there. Yeah, yeah, the don't know is understood. You don't have to raise your hand if you don't know. All right, so I mean, I agree that this is, and all right, so I just wanted, I'm glad that this is a bit controversial because I wanted to make a comment about why I think that this is a natural assumption, okay? So I want to talk about the, an observational reason to think that there are some special initial conditions, some finite volume initial conditions. And that's just by looking at our backward light cone. Okay? Let's think about what happens to our backward light cone. So here we are. We look at our backward light cone. And initially, as you go back into the past, the area is increasing in this direction. Okay? And then at some point, the area starts decreasing. Now, at this point, you have three options. There's only three options for what can happen back here. One is that you violate the null energy condition. Okay? Then there's no constraint. You can do a lot of different things. Okay? But on the other hand, you're in danger of losing the generalized second law of black hole, thermodynamics, and so on. Okay? So this is definitely something you could do, but it's radical. The second possibility is that there could be a singularity in the past. That this area goes to zero and ends on a singularity. And once you have that, you can either put initial conditions on the singularity, or you can try to resolve the singularity. The third, and by far the most boring option, is simply that this area goes to zero in a non-singular way, either by some origin of polar coordinates, or just by encountering the initial condition surface. Okay, so this is sort of the boring option. And as an example of this boring option, suppose you had De Sitter space, and suppose we're living in this bubble here, and here's our backward light cone. If we put in this initial conditions here at a finite time, then this backward light cone gets very small, but it's just still finite size there. Or if you continue to follow it all the way back, it just gets to R equals zero in a non-singular way. Okay? But either way, if you want to employ this boring option, it means that you have something finite back here. Okay? And well, that's true. So I guess what I should say is if you're going to employ this one, then you just you need to have a finite spatial slice somewhere so that backward light cone can go back to zero. Okay. Well, what happens in this example is that there's an entire Cauchy surface there, okay, and it's finite, and I think that's the only way that this area can go to zero, unless you just stop the thing at some initial condition surface. Then it could be infinite. Okay, and so if you really like, so in this potential that I drew here, let me get to what I'm trying to say here, okay? So this potential here, we could have put these initial conditions that were finite and gave a finite probability for eternal inflation. For this potential, there's a different nice set of boundary conditions, which is the asymptotically ADS boundary conditions, okay? Those are beautiful. There's nothing wrong with choosing those, okay? But if you want to have a space where you have asymptotically ADS out here at spatial infinity, that's a self-consistent thing that's a self-consistent boundary condition to impose. Let me kind of draw it like this. And then you want to have us in here, okay? Then you need to violate the null energy condition somewhere in there, okay? Because the area of this backward light cone would get to be infinite, okay? Or you need to resolve a singular. You have to do something crazy in between, okay? And so, right. So if you want to have asymptotically ADS or Minkowski, you can certainly do that. But that's inconsistent with the contraction of our backward light cone, unless you do something exciting. Okay, let me lump those things together into null energy condition violation. Okay? And so we can't really have these nice asymptotics that we wanted. Now you could say, okay, but maybe this is negotiable. Does this area really have to start decreasing towards the past? Okay? So let me briefly ask, is the fact that A dot becomes negative towards the past, is that negotiable? And so you can just compute. It's good enough to do it in the homogeneous approximation when that area starts decreasing, okay? If we use what we think we know about cosmology. And the answer is that it happens at a time which is related to our current FRW time, divided by 27. Okay? It happens at a scale factor, which is related to our current scale factor, by a factor of 9. I assume matter domination to do this, but I think it's a good approximation. Okay, so this is pretty recent that this happened. And so you'd have to really change known physics in order to avoid this conclusion. If you want somebody to just make our universe, they'd have to do it really recently if they want to make it in the lab, okay? And so this is really non-negotiable. And so you could easily forbid eternal inflation with these nice boundary conditions, but you'd be forbidding standard cosmology as well. You'd be forbidding basically more than one e-folding of inflation, unless you do some other exciting things here. Okay, so I just wanted to provide a little additional motivation for having some special initial conditions somewhere that allow for eternal inflation to start in a non-singular way. All right. So now, given the theory and the initial conditions, we still need to know how to make predictions. And it turns out that there's some surprisingly subtle questions here. Everybody thinks that they know the answer, and the answer is obvious, but unfortunately we don't agree on what that answer is. Okay, so how do we make predictions? So first of all, if we're just in a large classical universe, a very large classical universe, let's say this large classical universe has one LHC that measures 125 GeV, and it has two LHCs that measure 141 GeV. And these are pretty far apart. So we don't know anything. We could be any one of these three. Those are all consistent with our data. What is the prediction for what we should see? Sorry, these are Higgs masses here. What is our prediction for what we should see for the Higgs mass? Okay? And this is all one big classical universe. But these people are too far away for us to have seen yet. Okay? This is just one big classical universe on the blackboard. And we know everything about it, except we don't know where we are. We might be here, we might be here, we might be here. Okay? And Jim Hartle and Bart Shrednicki pointed out that really this is an additional assumption, which is the typicality assumption. The probability of two different outcomes is proportional to the relative number. The probability for two different observations is just given by counting the relative number of each kind of observation. Okay. So, are you prepared to vote on typicality? So, who's going to vote yes? This is a good assumption. All right, that's still around what I was calling 30. Okay, and who's going to vote no? 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. Okay. It's not always the same 6 people, but I really am counting the no's. Okay. Now, we're not quite done yet with how to implement typicality. Okay, because now, suppose we're in a different situation. So now, suppose we're in a quantum situation, or just some situation with some uncertainty. And let's suppose that with probability 50%, or you could write this as a wave function if you wanted, there's an unfriendly universe. And that unfriendly universe has just one LHC that measures 125. And with probability 50%, there is a slightly friendlier universe that has two LHCs. Okay? It's either or. Somebody flips a coin and either makes this universe or that universe. Okay? We need to, and of course there's more general versions of this question. No, I'm not getting into that. So the wave function is a superposition of this and that. Okay? Now we want to predict what we should see there. Okay, so let me call this quantum typicality. And I'm going to let you vote, but first let me try to influence the outcome of the vote. Okay? Really, we think that this theory is the same as this theory. Because you can describe eternal inflation globally, where there's one big universe and this stuff happens somewhere and this stuff happens somewhere else. Or you can describe it locally in one causal patch. When you describe it locally in one causal patch, you have a wave function and either this happens or that happens. So, and there's a surprisingly, there's a remarkable, a remarkably precise mapping between the global description and the local description, which was called global-local duality, that Raphael and Yisheng described in some detail for particular measures and so on. But I think more generally we kind of expect this to be true, that you have the option of a global description or a local description. And so what I'm going to advocate is just using typicality in the probability ensemble and just putting expectation values here. Okay? And basically what that means is that in this situation, you would again say there's a two-thirds probability that we'll measure 141 GeV. Okay? So can I have a vote on this? I wasn't specifically talking about causal patches, but let's say that they're in the same. To make that analogy work, they would be in the same causal patch. Yeah. They were just far away. We just haven't seen them yet. They're... Okay. So I'm going to make this assumption, which is basically applying typicality to the probability ensemble. So who is going to support me in that proposition? Oh, okay. maybe 13. And who's gonna vote no on this one? One, two, three, four. Okay. All right. There's a lot of undecideds on this. And I'll have to tell you that there's some bad news about this, which is that the people who feel that they're experts on this, which I think are philosophers, think that this is a controversial question. Okay, and we've invited a philosopher to come and hopefully straighten this out. I don't know if he's here yet. I guess not. So hopefully on Friday he will tell us the answer to this. But while many of these assumptions are things that we could imagine making progress on, this one is actually, I think it's a very natural assumption, but it's hard to see how you would derive it from something that we know to be true. Okay, so, and this is related to something that's called the Sleeping Beauty paradox, if you guys want to look that up on Wikipedia when you're done with your email up there. Okay, so these are basically the assumptions that I need here. And with these assumptions, I'm going to conclude that eternal inflation is in our past. So I'm going to conclude from these assumptions that we are at late time in an eternally inflating universe. And the reason is basically just using this assumption of typicality along with my other assumptions. So here's a finite universe. And here's an eternally inflating universe. Okay? You get the idea. Now we can ignore this finite universe, and we can ignore any finite amount of time in the eternally inflating universe. 100% of the people with these typicality assumptions are at late times in the eternally inflating universe. So the crucial question is whether there is a finite probability for eternal inflation, which we assumed to be the case. And this is what I mean by saying that there's eternal inflation in our past. Of course, eternal inflation has to end locally, and there has to be some reheating and so on. But the statement is that we're at arbitrarily late time in this eternally inflating universe. Okay. Now, there's obviously different sets of assumptions that you could make and so on, but I think this is one reasonable set of assumptions that would lead you to this conclusion, that eternal inflation is the thing we have to understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think in that situation, I mean, keep in mind I'm using typicality, but so we have some minimum. Let's consider this potential, but ignore this part. So just make it go up there. It doesn't even need to be that complicated. Well, that's fine. So you could just have that. You could just have this potential. In that potential, you could have some initial conditions. But the typical people will live at very late time after those initial conditions. And so, yes. I mean, this, of course, I'm not going to say this agrees with observation, and that's where I'm going. But I would conclude in this model that we live at arbitrarily late time after the initial conditions. Yeah. Well, just the statement that, so we're going to assume that we're typical observers. And incidentally, defining observers more carefully, I agree, is a problem that needs to be addressed. But it's a bit orthogonal to what we're talking about right now. But so we're assuming that we're typical observers here. And, okay, you can start here and have some nice observers at the beginning, but there will be an infinite number at later times just because of the thermal fluctuations. So the typical observers in that theory are at late times. Okay, but this actually brings me to the next thing I wanted to talk about, is could this possibly agree with observation? 10. Perfect. Okay. Now, all right, so this is part two. Could we agree with observation? First of all, I just want to say that this is a dangerous question. This could easily go wrong, okay? And the types of things that, for example, Neil was discussing, whether the theory predicts a universe as flat as what we see, those are the types of things that keep us up at night, and I would invite people to read our papers on the subject. These are big, important questions. Okay? Now, the first thing we need in order to even address this question is we need a measure. Because eternal inflation produces infinities, and as Alan described, this ratio, so these things are infinite. Let me put expectation values. These expectation values are infinite, and so their ratio needs to be regulated. In order for this proposal to make sense. Now, there's two possibilities at this point. One is to just say, well, eternal inflation is not predictive because that ratio doesn't make sense. Okay? And certainly in perturbative GR, in perturbative quantum gravity, let's say, then the answer is just that this ratio is ill-defined. There's clearly no preferred perturbatively, there's clearly no preferred cutoff. You can choose one time variable or another time variable. The theory is diffeomorphism invariance. It's just not well defined. Okay? But what I think so let me list this as an assumption now. So a further assumption is going to be that quantum gravity provides, when we completely understand it, regulates these infinities and defines NA over NB. And the reason to hold out some hope for this is that these infinities arise from regions that are out of causal contact with each other. They arise from counting people over here and over there. What we've learned from black holes is that the semi-classical description is reliable locally, but it's unreliable when you want to ask questions about a region of space that's bigger than any one observer can see. Okay? And so there's a reason to think that there are important corrections to the semi-classical description here. And these infinities are exactly coming from those regions that are out of causal contact. And so I think there's just a motivation to think that quantum gravity will regulate these infinities and make this quantity well-defined. And I guess since I've given you the opportunity to vote, you get to vote on this one too. So who's going to support me that quantum gravity will regulate these infinities? The correct description. Whatever the correct description is. All right. That's maybe 15 or so. And who's going to vote no? One, two, three? Seven, I think seven. Okay. Okay. All right. But now, given a measure, you can then go on to ask these more concrete questions about the curvature. And I just wanted to mention briefly what the story is about the curvature. Of course, there's a lot of questions you want to ask once you have a measure, and for most of them, you need to know a lot more about the landscape. But let's just ask about the curvature. Does this predict a large flat universe or not? So the first assumption for that is that the tuning of the potential. What I mean by the tuning of potential is we look at the string theory landscape and we see how many regions there are which allow for a lot of inflation. That gives some probability distribution over the number of e-foldings, just from looking at how much tuning it takes in the potential. And I want to assume that that probability only grows like a power law with the number of e-foldings. So in other words, that there's not an exponential tuning of the potential required in order to get a large number of e-foldings. Okay, it's not important that this is exactly a power law. What's important is that this is sub-exponential. How fast does the probability of more e-foldings go to zero for large numbers of e-foldings? So this is something that I analyzed with Matt Kleban and Lenny Susskind and Maria Martinez, and that a number of other people have analyzed more recently. And it's something that we still don't understand well, but our claim was that this probability distribution went like 1 over the number of e-foldings to the fourth. If you write down something like the potential equals, if you write down some finite number of terms here, like, say, the renormalizable ones, and put some Bohring distribution on these coefficients, you'll get some sort of power law like that. Okay? So the assumption is that the tuning of the potential has only a power law cost. Who's going to say that that is a reasonable assumption? Reasonable. Who's going to vote yes for this? Yeah, in the potential. Yeah. Yeah. We're going to get to the next question in a moment. Yeah. Yeah. Slow roll. That's right. So who's going to vote yes? Okay. My support is eroding. About 10. And who's going to vote no? Okay, we're at about 10 and 3. I think it's probably time to stop talking here. Pretty soon, everyone's going to be asleep, I guess. Okay. Now, there's a second issue, obviously, here, about whether we expect to see negative curvature, whether we expect to see a lot of curvature, which is not the tuning of the potential, but the tuning of the initial conditions, roughly, when you tunnel into a vacuum. So we've assumed here that eternal inflation is dominating. There's some steady-state behavior. And at late times, the way you make pocket universes is you tunnel in. But you might get unlucky and not tunnel onto the slow roll portion of the potential. Okay? So you have to tunnel onto the inflationary plateau. And one thing that Lenny and Matt and Maria and I argued, and I have to say, give Lenny most of the credit for actually doing this, we discovered that negative curvature provides an enormous amount of friction that really solves the overshoot problem for you. And so this works much better than you might think. The danger is that the value of the potential here is much lower than it is up here if you think that we came from some Planckian thing. And so you might worry about just overshooting that potential. It turns out that negative curvature really just solves that problem for you. And it's an interesting question to consider in a more interesting multidimensional potential. I mean, we just looked at the simplest possible thing of a one-dimensional potential. And so I want to assume that that the tuning of the initial conditions from tunneling again provides something that's only power law. That it doesn't take an exponential tuning of the... these aren't the ultimate initial conditions. These are just the initial conditions you get from tunneling. I want to assume that the probability only goes down like a power law there as well. So who's going to vote yes on that? Wow. Okay. Well, we did actually do a calculation, which does actually provide support for that. And who's going to vote no? Okay. So I guess Yisheng has a new calculation. All right. So obviously the talk is almost over because we only have 3-1 on that. To which? Thank you. Okay. So, right. Okay. And so the picture that emerges here is a picture that's very much like, with these assumptions, the picture that emerges is very much like with the cosmological constant, where most pockets have a very small number of E-foldings, but most observers see a large number of E-foldings. And that's one of the things that surprised us, is that the anthropic prediction works out so well. And that's something that we've tried to generalize and so on in recent work. I mean, this is really one of the few things that we've studied well, and I think this really does work quite well, subject to some assumptions that need some further thought. All right. So this is just one example of a place where the theory could have gone wrong, and it appears to go right with some plausible assumptions. And I'd be very interested to hear if you have some concern about either this statement or particularly this statement, because that's the most that's the easiest one to analyze. Okay, so that's why I think eternal inflation is in our past. And I did want to take one final vote. So there's going to be two questions. One question is, do you think that eternal inflation is in our past? And the second question is whether you agree with all of my assumptions. Because everybody has their own reason for believing things. Okay. So first of all, is eternal inflation in our past? Who's going to vote yes on that? All right, let me actually count this time. 1, 2, 3, 4. Sorry? The definition of eternal inflation is that you get an infinite volume in the false vacuum. All right, that was in the neighborhood of 20. I'm more interested in no. So who votes no on eternal inflation in our past? All right, good. It's pretty even. Okay, it's maybe like 20 to 14 or something. Somebody could count more carefully. All right, and who agrees with all of my assumptions that I've made during the past 45 minutes? Thank you, guys. I appreciate that. Thank you, Lenny. mostly people of a certain age agree with my assumptions at this stage. Okay, thank you. I look forward to talking about these things this week.
Okay, questions for Ben.
I guess you...
So, my personal opinion is that your least reasonable assumption is the one that I think Tom was getting at, when you put an ultraviolet cutoff on the space of conditions at early times. If you... Mm-hmm. Maybe we can play fancy games with holography and regularizations and whatever, but if you do the traditional semi-classical space-time thing, that little patch grows, and if you have an ultraviolet cutoff at a fixed physical size, the number of states compatible with that cutoff grows without bound, but the space of states that had begun with eternal inflation does not grow. So right. The fraction of states that actually had eternal inflation in the past goes to zero as you choose different times in the future to draw that initial condition slice. So in my personal opinion, that is completely cheating to choose that moment at early times to put an ultraviolet cutoff.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, but really what you're emphasizing is just there is something special about these initial conditions. Okay, you know, maybe there's some pretty theory like Hartle-Hawking or something. Something else that gives you these pretty initial conditions. But I agree.
It needs to be part of your assumptions, I would say. The need for such a theory.
Sorry. I guess Matt is in charge of who's asking the questions here. So I think some people in front here would like to.
I want to ask you the same question. This has nothing to do with your talk. The same question that I wanted to ask Alan. Is Alan here? I don't even know if he's here anymore. Exactly the same question. Do you think with everything that we know or assume the basic set of assumptions that go into eternal inflation now, that there is an answer to this measure problem. We just haven't unraveled it, and we haven't analyzed it to completion. The answer is there, but we just haven't done it yet. Or do you think that there's something really big missing that's necessary to determine what the measure is? And the other side of the question is, also to Alan, how important is it that the measure problem be solved? Or how important is it that there exists a solution? How important is it that there is a measure? Those are two questions I would ask almost for anybody who addresses these questions.
Well, maybe I can address a little part of your question. I mean, I do think we're missing something huge, which is, you know, the rigorous description of eternal inflation, the holographic description, whatever it is, that's completely rigorous. And that's the thing that's going to tell us whether this quantity makes sense or not. And I would really say, you know, either we have a rigorous description that makes this make sense, or this whole way of thinking about things, making anthropic statistical predictions, is just completely wrong. So I don't see any way you could rescue a part of it.
I would vote for that. But what would happen if we come to the conclusion that there simply is no rule for a measure?
I think then we have to kill eternal inflation in some way or else. Okay. Because the alternative is to just admit that our theory is not predictive in any way.
Okay, I also vote for that.